Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back, as is Katie Schaefer. Today we are talking about the 1998 novel Bag of Bones. It's not one of King's most popular novels, but as Katie and I were reading through it, we did notice some good things about it. Katie, thank you for joining me to discuss it, and how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, and thanks for having me back to talk about it. I thought this book was really unexpectedly good for how well known it is, because it's, like you said, it's definitely not one of his books that people talk about generally when you talk about Stephen King novels.
Yeah, I had heard a little bit about the adaptation, probably simply because it was done by Mick Garris, but it was much later. You know, it happened over a decade after the book came out, and sometimes that will happen with Stephen King stuff. Sometimes you just kind of don't know what to expect with some of these lesser known properties. But after reading the book, I see why it took a while for it to be adapted. But at the same time, I still found a lot of things that felt very Stephen King-esque in this, obviously because he wrote it. But it was surprising to me, I guess, that people weren't really talking about this one as much as some of his other books.
Right. And I totally get you. Like, it is very much a Stephen King novel. You know, it's about a writer. It's set in Maine, in rural Maine for the most part. Like, it's so in his wheelhouse, but it also feels kind of different than his other work. And it feels like, as we've been discussing his more recent novels, like, it definitely feels like in this era, he was playing around a lot and trying to tell different stories in different ways and see how far out he could branch. And even though this is definitely supernatural, it also feels much more grounded in reality than some of his other supernatural books.
Absolutely. And I think the characters are what really make the story tick, because you really only have a handful that matter in the grand scheme of things. You have Mike Noonan, you have Maddie and Kira DeVore, Max DeVore, who is the grandfather of Kira. So he's sort of trying to steal her away because his son died and now Maddie's a single mom. And you have this family dynamic that I think is something that's really common, especially when someone and their in-laws don't get along and there's something at stake as far as, you know, a child growing up and having money and all sorts of different factors that go into raising a child and what you need to have at least as a minimum to be able to do that.
Yes, exactly. And this gets into it in a pretty heart-wrenching way, because it doesn't necessarily talk a whole lot about the legal side of it. Instead, it really talks about the connection between Maddie and her daughter, Kira, and how it affects everyone around them and how Maddie is affected by the town looking at her. And it just really tries to explore it in a way that we don't, that is so Stephen King, especially if we look at something like Rose Matter. This feels like it's examining something like this in the same kind of perspective. We don't see it a lot in other literature, I would say.
Yeah, I think just the fact that you then have Mike intervening, and it's like he's only ever met this girl once before he decides that he's going to intervene because she's running out and is like in the middle of the road or something and could possibly get hit by a car. So he gets her out of the way, and he's sort of like this big quote unquote hero, and he doesn't feel that way. And then the town already knows what's going on, what the situation is between Max and Maddie and the girl. And you just have this very small town, everyone knows everyone's business vibe that I think is very key in a lot of Stephen King's stories, because of the fact that you do know this is taking place in Maine. You have the dairy connection at the beginning, and then he goes off and goes to sort of the summer house that's out on a lake. And then you have this whole ghost story aspect to it that just brings it all in a different way than you expect when you first get a feel for how Mike's relationship is sort of going to play out between Maddie and the girl.
Yeah. And so, like you said, this is so, the small town is almost like a character in this one, which is very similar to something like Needful Things or in It with Derry. There's so much going on in regards to, there's all these little characters kind of developed that tell you about different people in the town and attitudes, but they all very much feel as of a piece. And that affects so much of, well, how is this going to affect Maddie? Because, you know, she's grown up in this small town, and now Mike is kind of diving into it, and the town also knows, like, all of the stuff about him. And his wife Jo has been there, and he didn't know that was going on. And so there's obviously so much depth to what's happening that you as the reader and Mike as the protagonist don't know until, gosh, it's like pretty close to the end of the book. Do you realize how much more information the town has about Mike and his, you know, dead wife than he has about them and what's going on?
Right. And because Mike's wife, Jo, was keeping things from him when she was alive, there's this weird thing in the air that you can just sense throughout a lot of the book. And you're kind of left wondering, oh, was she actually up to something that wasn't good? And that's why she was keeping it from him. There is that doubt that you have because Mike has that doubt.
Right. And that's played so well because you can't really tell, or at least I couldn't really tell. Like, a lot of times when you read novels like this and there is that moment, the author kind of tips you off from how they're writing about it. But King really walks this fine, or rather veers along this fine line of giving you an incident where it's like, oh, well, you know, there's definitely something nefarious going on. And then you get to the other side of, oh, of course she wouldn't do that because of how Mike is feeling throughout the book as he's finding out little bits of information until he finally just decides to say, you know, screw this, and digs down deep into what happened by calling around and talking to his wife's friends and family. And then you get this sense of peace about it as a reader, and it allows the story to move to the next level, which again happens probably in the start of the climactic part of the book, I would say, is when we really get this confirmation that Jo is a positive figure and everything, as opposed to this nebulous, maybe she's good, maybe she's bad.
I really do like her as a character, even though you have no real knowledge of who she is beyond what Mike is willing to give us. And that's an interesting way to get to know a character, because you're getting to know her not through her own actions necessarily, but just through someone else's eyes.
Right. She's very mysterious from the beginning of the book, but he paints her in such a lovely way. And there's a little interview after the, because of course I listen to the audiobook because I always do. There's a little interview afterward where King talks about the process of writing this book and what inspired him to do it and all of this. And in case anyone was wondering, why, yes, this, his wife is very much the basis for Jo in this book, Tabitha King. So you get this sense of love that Mike's describing that feels very genuine. And so you feel by the end that you almost know her despite her never really even getting a full scene in the book.
Yeah, I like that he did have her death be so early on, that a lot of this is Mike trying to work through it. And obviously you have like the 4-year time jump where he's going to the lake house finally and he's getting ready to write another novel, which King writing about writers is way more common in a lot of his stories than I realized. Obviously, The Shining is kind of the big one that most people know about because you have Jack Torrance trying to be a writer. And it's just one of those things where you always hear write what you know. But we all know for a fact that, you know, there isn't a clown in the sewers in this town in Maine, even if it's a fictional town in the book. So he is writing what he knows to an extent, and then letting his imagination run with it in a way that I think makes his books compelling, because he does all of this character work and the twist and the horror is almost secondary.
Yes, I agree. I think because he writes about writing and being a writer so much, he's really mastered the ability to both tell a story and tell about someone else writing a story and kind of interplay those two things together. And in this one, I think it's the most successful I've seen him be at it, as because you're interested in Mike's process, or at least I was interested in Mike's process of writing and wondering, like, oh, is he going to be able to write again and all of that. And that feels so important to the story, that whether or not he's going to be able to do it. And I do like that he took that 4-year gap, because it made it feel like there was a genuine grieving process for Mike. You know, he had been with his wife for a really long time, and you don't just get over something like that quickly. And it'll gives him time to build up the suspense with the dreams that he's having about their summer house, Sarah's Laughter, which is the weirdest house for a name ever, by the way.
Sarah Laughs,
thank you. And
still weird either way.
It's totally weird. And they really ramp up the creepiness level of that through those dreams. And it's such an interesting way to play it out of, I kind of knew, of course, that we're going to end up at the lake house, and that's where things are going to play themselves out. But I was surprised at how many twists and turns I didn't expect in this, and how the house is haunted and all of that came as a total surprise to me, that there's so much going on with that. I really was surprised at how well he was able to pull that off.
Right? It's just so fascinating to see how these things all come together in the end, especially for a book that is fairly long, because my copy of it was about 730 pages, which I'm sure the hardcover is much shorter in length, just because bigger pages can fit more words. But
right,
for the mass market paperback size, that's a pretty big book by King standards.
Yeah, I mean, I think the audiobook was somewhere like 23 hours or so, which for me is like not that long. Once we get to 40 hours, that's when we're talking, it's a long book for me. But it went pretty quickly, and I was engaged almost immediately, like because I didn't know what was going to happen. And I loved that part about it. And I feel like I didn't really get the sense that this was a ghost story even until, I don't know, like a little bit of a ways in, until really he gets to the house and the dreams start coming true.
Yeah.
That's when it confirmed for me, like, okay, this is a ghost story as opposed to, you know, a demon like It or something like that.
And at first you don't know, because of the refrigerator people, as, you know, they end up being called, not necessarily refrigerator, you know.
Right.
She uses a slightly different version of refrigerator. She
yep.
has
yep.
such cute names for all of these different words that she can't pronounce. But you have these letters on a fridge that so many of us have seen, some of us probably even had, and both Maddie and Mike have them on their refrigerators. So they are both getting these weird messages, and the letters are moving. And at first you think, okay, well, you know, that ghost isn't really harmful, so you don't think about that too much. And then, you know, there's this connection between Mike and Kyra, not sure.
It's Kyra.
Kyra, okay. I was saying that wrong earlier, so my apologies, but Kyra, she and Mike have this connection, and you're kind of like, okay, is this going to be more sci-fi like? You know, kind of like, where is he going with this? Because we've seen what happens when people have connections in some of his other stories. You know, you and I didn't particularly enjoy the Tommyknockers, but you could tell how they were kind of connecting with people's minds and taking over people's minds and making them do things. And in this, it's like they just knew things without having any clue how they knew them. And by the end of it, you find out that it's more of a curse too. So all of these ghosts are coming about because of this curse, due to what happened to Sarah Tidwell decades and, you know, generations ago.
Yeah, that ending is, oof, that is one
it's
of the
rough.
More graphic. Yeah, one of the more graphic King scenes I've read, and I've read a lot of graphic King scenes, but I do feel that he handles it pretty well. Like, it's awful from beginning to end. Everything about it is awful from beginning to end, and he has built up the suspense to knowing absolutely nothing about what happened. You know that the little boy died, before you see this scene, but you don't know what happened. And so as it continues and you see the effects of what happened, of all of these children who've died, all of these adults who've killed themselves, and how it's affected this town, you know that it has to be bad. It has to be really bad. It can't just be that a child was drowned. It has to be something much more awful to engender this kind of terrible, what at this point, it's like a century of death and hatred and protection of the town, trying to, I don't know, keep outsiders from knowing or being under the sway of the curse. So when you get there, it was almost to the point where I was like, I don't want to look. I don't want to look. I don't want to know how bad this is, because I know it's just going to be gruesome.
Yeah.
And it should be. I mean, it for this kind of story, it should have that level of upsetting tone to it in order to sell the previous things that have happened and in order to really get the point across. Because I will say that because of the fact that all of this is very much rooted in racism, and King talks pretty regularly about racism in his books, and in this one I think it's his most blatant of denigrating and calling out the horrific consequences of racism for both the people who experience it and the generations beyond. And I think that's done really well in this book, despite how brutal it is.
Absolutely. And it was one of those things where you knew that something horrible was going to happen aside from Jo's death, and we find out later that she was pregnant. So then she was the one putting all of these pieces together, and Mike is left trying to figure out why she was sneaking around. He thinks she was having an affair, which is what a lot of people probably thought, because she ended up being in town with her brother, who I'm guessing nobody else in town knew, so they just thought he was this other man. At least that's clearly what Maddie kind of thought once she realized what she was telling Mike when he asked her. And you get this whole thing where Mike then contacts Frank, and he is like, oh, no, yeah, she called me. And this weight kind of lifts off of Mike's shoulder, because at least she wasn't having an affair. And he definitely knows that the kid was his, you know, and that's sort of a relief in this kind of morbid sense, because obviously the death still happened of both his wife and to-be child. And then he has to figure out what she was doing. So Frank kind of gives him that nudge in the right direction, and he realizes that Sarah's attackers, you know, there are people in this town who are descendants of the men who attacked her, and that's the tie to all of these curses and deaths.
Right. And that was such a big, great reveal. Like, the end, when you find out that that's what's been going on, is so well done. And I like that he also foreshadows the fact that Mike doesn't necessarily believe that his wife was cheating on him. And he's reassured when the scene where the bell is ringing on the moose head, and he's watching TV, and the TV is on mute, and then it comes blaring on when someone says, I never lied to you.
Right.
And he has this moment of realization of, like, I should be looking for other reasons. I'm going in the wrong direction, and I need to figure out what was really happening here, because it wasn't that she was cheating on me. And that spurs his desire to figure out and get to the bottom of it. And he has that moment of relief of knowing, like, oh, thank God, my suspicions were correct. It was something else happening. And it gets so intense for him when he's talking to her brother, and he then has this chain of revelations throughout the rest of the novel of how deep into this his wife was, and how she must have felt so completely alone because she couldn't talk to him because he was in the middle of writing a book and was completely dead to the world for the most part. So he has to go through this second level of grief of realizing that she wasn't able to talk to him about it, and so he wasn't able to help her and might have been able to save her. And so it layers on all of these different emotions so well, and it really is very affecting, I think.
Yeah, and the fact that you don't see the twist coming at all is even better, because I was so focused on what Mike was unraveling that you don't even think this whole other thing from a century ago is going to factor into what's going on today.
Right, right. And then you get that. I think for me, at least, I got that first hint when him and Kyra have that, like, tandem dream where they go back into the past at the, I don't know, some kind of fair or whatever. And then it kind of started to dawn on me and I was like, maybe this is not just a ghost story. This is like a generational ghost story of something that has continuously affected them. But even then it was like, I wasn't really sure what exactly had happened. And I love the fact that Sarah Tidwell is both a villain and a sympathetic character in this book,
mm-hmm.
especially by the end when you see what she's gone through and you realize her reaction is totally justified, especially when you find out that she's been possessed, kind of like that her ghost has been taken over kind of by more vengeful spirits. And I think that is definitely the most powerful moment when Mike talks about having sympathy and understanding for her, but is also like, I'm not going to let you do this anymore. Like, I get it, but girl, you can't keep doing this. And I'm not going to let you take this baby. No, no more. This is enough. And I think that's the most powerful aspect of the book for me, was that it allows the thing that has been essentially driving all of these killings to be redeemable. Because it's understandable when someone goes through such a horrific treatment that they would have such a reaction.
Yeah. It's one of those situations where you understand why it's happening, but because it keeps happening to children, you're like, okay, no, this is not okay. If you were going after, you know, these scummy men who clearly seem to live in this town because you have these descendants going and committing all of the crimes, basically, all of the murders, you see that these guys come and they just start shooting up Maddie's trailer while other people are there. You know, John is there, Romeo's there, I think George is there too. And you just have these other guys who are totally innocent in this whole thing. And really, everyone is totally innocent. And so it's kind of like, man, how long has this been going on in this town and nobody's done anything about it? And obviously, it had to be Mike who would figure it out because it was his house that was the haunted one and obviously mostly goes unoccupied during the year when he was living in Derry.
Right. It allows it to continue festering unnoticed. And because it wasn't occupied, it allows the townspeople to kind of turn a blind eye because it only comes up once in a while. So they can, oh, well, like the townsfolk of Derry in it, like this is their minds accepted as this is just how it is. This is just the costs. And because of the evil spiritual presence or whatever that kind of pushes them, that it, even at one point manages to take over Mike, it feels totally believable that they would just kind of let it continue happening.
Oh, totally. I want to dive into Mike a little more because we mentioned he's obviously the sort of king figure in this. He's the writer, and Joe is very much this ode to Tabitha, even though, you know, Tabitha is very much still alive, thankfully. But the thing about Mike is he has so many different things going on. He's trying to write this book. He's trying to help this mom and her daughter. And it really feels like the entire time he's just meant to be a father, even if it's not to a biological child. And that doesn't quite get resolved by the end of the book, which I think was a good move because you do have an epilogue, but it was one of King's better endings because you're left kind of like, okay, he really, really wants this, and she really, really wants this. So you have to just believe that the adoption was going to go through because even John is like, yeah, no, you'll get custody eventually. It's just going to be really slow because you're a single dude. And most times that ends up being a creepy situation. Not necessarily most times, but he said often enough to where they are going to take their time with the adoption process because, you know, Maddie isn't around, Joe isn't around. Anyone who Mike was interested in is no longer around to be this mother figure to Kyra.
Right. And this was in the 90s, so it wasn't, I mean, I'm sure to a certain extent it's still like that, but it was definitely more so prejudiced against single men. And I do enjoy that King talks about how, like, to a certain extent, it's unfair, but there's a reason for it.
Yeah.
He doesn't make it like, oh, this is just the system is against you. It's like, well, there's a reason why this is the way it is, unfortunately. And it's not your fault, but they're just trying to protect the child.
Right. And it's certainly understandable on all levels that we didn't need that resolution. We were like, okay, we understand what these two characters have gone through over the span of however long this book takes place. Because of the time jump, it's a little iffy because you have that beginning that takes place in a certain time and then you kind of jump 4 years later. But the story itself doesn't really span 4 entire years. But I'm willing to bet it spans at least a few weeks given how the legal system is.
Right, right. And yeah, it's definitely one of his strongest endings in the in the books that I've read recently of his, like, it, meaning the books he's written in the last, or from the time before this, like the last 5 to 10 years. Like, he really nails it with this, because, like, you're right, we don't need the congratulatory hug when he brings Kyra home and shows her new bedroom or something like that. And it makes more sense for the tone of this story that it ends with them still struggling, because for people who've gone through such trauma, like, to a certain extent, you are going to be struggling for a long time. And I think that's well represented with the ending of this book, with that King doesn't wrap things up neatly. He leaves it as, like, there are still battles to be fought in order for Mike to continue to be the one who's protecting Kyra, and that Mike is so incredibly set on doing so speaks very well to his character growth throughout this book.
Right. What do you think about the fact that some of the writing that he ends up doing just winds up being for himself, and he's kind of like, oh, maybe I'll let her read it one day, meaning Kyra, and she is certainly not of an age to be reliving all of these events so soon, but it's something that he is thinking about down the line, even though he doesn't have custody of her yet. And then, if I'm not mistaken, the book that he was working on, I don't think it ended up being released, did it?
No, he burns it.
Okay.
He burns it the night he brings Kyra back, like in the wood fire stove. Yep. Yep. Which I loved that part of it, that the book he's writing that he's so feverishly into and so scared of losing is really just kind of a cipher that his wife is feeding him that is there to answer a question. Like, that is so, so perfect. And as someone who writes and who's written a decent amount of fiction, like, a lot of what he describes of the experience of writing is really, really accurate in this book. And that fear of, like, once I've started this thing, I need to make sure that I continue doing it the exact same way so that I don't lose my idea is totally a thing. And so it feels very realistic. And you, I think, feel his loss at the end because of how much the pain he experiences over not being able to write is so well described. At the end, when he decides that he's going to retire, it also feels like such a big moment of growth for him, is to accept that, like, okay, that part of my life is over now, and now I need to move on because I can't morally continue to write the kind of stories that I do because it's too painful.
Plus, it's obvious he has plenty of money to live off of, which, you know, is not something that everyone can be fortunate enough to do at the age of, what, like 40? He's just retiring.
Yeah, 40, 42 or something. Like, I was like, me too, buddy, me too. Plus, he's getting royalties. If he's in the top 15 New York Times bestseller list, he's definitely getting royalties and republish payments. Yeah. So it's like, well, you kind of have, even though writing, of course, does not pay well for the vast majority of writers, if you hit that level, you're doing pretty good.
Which goes to show how much of Mike's character was sort of mimicking King's own life, because by this point he had written, I think this was the 40th book of his that was released, because he had written 30 something as King and a handful as Bachman. So he had a lot of books out by 1998, and this was the only book he released that year. But still, by that point, he probably had more money than he knew what to do with, even though I'm sure they were much smaller amounts when he first started writing in the 70s and really started hitting his stride in the 80s.
Oh, yeah. His first, he sold Carrie for $200,000, and that was huge. And yeah. This book, he got a $2 million advance and 50% of the profit sharing, which is, you got to be a big author to get profit sharing. And in the past, he was making roughly $17 to $18 million per book. So
that's crazy.
Yeah. He and King has been, you know, the biggest writer sitting closest to the success fire for decades at this point. And it's interesting to see his perspective on writers is still very much from this guy. It's like he hasn't really accepted how big he is, I would think. Because it's like, dude, you're so much bigger than this guy. And in the interview, when the person is talking to him, she kind of mentions how he's so much more successful, and he just kind of embarrassed chuckles. It's like, oh, you're so cute. You're still just like a back, you know, a main boy. It was very much how he comes across in interviews.
I think it helps that he still lives in Maine, too. He didn't get persuaded by, you know, the big Hollywood lights to go live out in Los Angeles or even, you know, hit the big city in New York or something like that. He has always stayed in Maine, as far as I know. Obviously, he's traveled to other places for book signings and events and, you know, premieres of his movies and things like that. But as far as where he spends the majority of his time, the family is still in Maine, from what I can tell.
Yeah. Yep. I think he lives in a lake house now, according at least to that interview that he gave. I think he grew up in Bangor or around Bangor, and that's where he lived for a really long time.
Yeah, that's where, like, the Stephen King house is that he doesn't actually live in anymore.
Yep. And I think that's when he sold that house, he moved to, like, a lake house in much more remote area of Maine. So he is very much in the heart of that country. And you can tell that a lot of his books, since a lot of his books are placed there, it means a lot to him and has done a lot of inspiring of his work, I think.
Yeah, I think Maine and Colorado have sort of been the main inspirations for his stories, because he spent quite a bit of time in Colorado, which is where I am now. And just driving around, you can sort of understand how parts of this could maybe feel similar to Maine.
Yes, definitely. I mean, you don't have the ocean side part of it, but there's certainly high places in Maine and lots of woodlands and trees. And that's certainly part of the Rockies area. And that's kind of where everything, when he writes in Colorado, is centered. It's always around Boulder and Denver and that more northern central area of Colorado rather than further south where you hit more like a desert climate.
Yeah, exactly. I do want to talk about some of the fun little tidbits in this, because you have a mention of Royce Merrill, and we know the Merrill family very, very well by this point in Stephen King lore. So it was just a nice little touch that he was kind of like, he doesn't have kids, he's kind of hanging on to the Merrill family name.
Yeah, what other stuff is he in? Because I remembered the name and I was like, oh, where have I heard this? Which connection is this from?
Well, I think it's just more so a connection to like Ace Merrill from The Body, and you have Merrill in Castle Rock now for that adaptation. There's just so many of the family members who pop up in the stories. I believe The Sun Dog was one of his novellas that centered around the Merrill family a lot, too.
Yep, I see that. Like, it's fascinating to see how he seeds his books with, like, oh, there's this little connection. Even in something like this, which feels very disconnected from the typical, you know, Stephen King universe that there so obviously is in the rest of his books. Even this one has just a little touch. And as you get, in my experience at least, as you get further along in his writing career, there's more and more of that.
Oh, absolutely. And there were just mentions of these little things. I think Bill Denborough got a mention in passing, and he really tied it in just by having Derry involved at the beginning.
Yep, and he mentions the sheriff of Castle Rock and Polly from Needful Things. When he talks to the state trooper, the head of the state troopers, Mike asks about him.
Yeah. So you just have these little connections where you're kind of like, okay, I can kind of place where some of these characters fit in as far as the timeline goes, which is always pretty helpful because he slides in these little things and you're like, oh, okay. And then he mentions Thad Beaumont from The Dark Half because, yes, you know, another writer, of course, has to get mentioned. So it's just funny how many little things he'll slip in here and there. And honestly, a lot of times they do slip past me.
Well, in books this long, it's understandable. Not all of them are as obvious as, like, you know, in Insomnia with the character that's in the Dark Tower, or Needful Things, where it's the same one of the same more big side characters from Rose Matter, where it's like, oh, I've definitely seen this person before.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up Insomnia because Mike Noonan appears in that book before we even meet him in this book. He had a conversation with Ralph,
yes,
at a restaurant.
And that's in this one, too. He talks about that conversation with Ralph because I remember I hear Ralph and I was like, where is that guy? Where is that? Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, I loved that there's all these little bits of it because that makes it just so much more rewarding to be someone who reads a lot of Stephen King because you kind of keep an eye out for those. And it makes it worth rereading Stephen King stuff because, like you said, it's hard to catch them all. And so when I find myself rereading stuff, I'll catch more and more of those little items.
It'll obviously be a while before I start rereading things.
Yes.
Not yes, for the podcast because, you know, you and I have The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon coming up. And I have read that before, but it was one of the very first King things that I read. So it's been way too long because when I was younger, I was picking up the short books. And I was like, oh, right, look at these. I can read this one. It's not that long. And I read, you know, the little Green Mile books one at a time at some point, which I probably was a little too young to read those, like I mentioned in our episode on that. But it's just so fun to see what you can catch. And like I said, I don't even catch everything. So I applaud the people who, one, have a little more time to read these than I do because I put these ridiculous deadlines on myself for this podcast. So you can spend more time with the books. And, you know, that's maybe my only regret doing it this way is that I'm plowing through them so fast. But I know if I didn't do it that way, it would just drag on forever and ever and ever.
And it'll also, once you, you know, once you've gotten to the end of it and you're just doing as the current stuff comes, then it does give you the opportunity to go back and reread the good ones. So you know you never need to read the Tommyknockers ever again.
Yes.
Cujo, maybe worth reading again. At least that's, you know, Dolores Claiborne, I'll definitely read that one again. And Gerald's Game, even though I've read Gerald's Game twice, I'll still read it again in a few years just because of, you know, the good ones.
Yeah, I will say that I definitely plan to go back and read the uncut version of The Stand because I had the edited version. So that one I am absolutely going to go back and read again because I did buy that newer version because you can't even buy the edited version anymore unless you happen to find it at a used bookstore or on Thrift Books or something like that. But
right,
we're straying a little from Bag of Bones here. Katie, do you have any final thoughts on this book?
I did want to talk about how great that conflict scene is between when Devore and Mike and Rojette all meet in the woods and yes, they're trying to essentially kill him and how intense that gets. Like at first with how frail he describes the both of them, it's like, oh, okay, it'll be fine. This is just like an awkward conflict. And then as it continues and you discover that Rojette is apparently a 70-year-old amazing softball pitcher, oh, shit, there's some real danger here. And you discover yeah, that along with Mike. And I think that's just, it was by far and away the best conflict scene and probably really the only conflict scene that's with a real human other than the shootout.
We do need to talk about those two a little more because I think they were the perfect pairing for the antagonists in this story, even though ultimately there are bigger things at play with the curse and the ghosts and things like that. But like you said, actual people, they're just
yes,
so evil. You know, Max is literally trying to buy his granddaughter and take her right, away from her mother, which is something that even John, the lawyer, is like, Yeah, that usually doesn't work, especially given his age. And it's like when he knows he's going to lose, he just takes his life to be in complete control. And then Rosette is kind of just, I don't want to say the mastermind because she's not, but she's just equally as disturbed as Max is.
Right. She feels like the crazy ascendant, you know, where she's willing to step into his shoes and take over when he dies, and how deep it goes.
Or and the press conference.
Yes. And the call that she makes to the lawyer and then lies about how the money, you know, like you see at the end when you learn all of that stuff, you see how far thought out this whole situation was, and you see how dedicated to the destruction of this child both of these people were. And it really, really enhances how dark and how upsetting those characters are.
You get this sense that, yes, they were nice to her when she would go stay with them, but in the grand scheme of things, you're like, these people are not good for her. Yes, Max DeVore might have all the money in the world, but you know what? So does Mike.
And if he doesn't have love for her, genuine, real love for the child, then no, children need that. That's by far and away the most important thing in a child's life, is to feel that unconditional love of a parental figure. And you can tell that neither one of them have that. It's all about what they can get out of her. And that is just evil, to try to rip a child away from her obviously caring mother in order to fulfill their own twisted desires.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. And I just really liked how everything came together in the end, even if that ending was brutal. Because earlier I said it was rough, and I didn't mean rough in a bad sense. It was just hard to read. It's kind of like when you get the scene with Beverly towards the end of It, and you're like, oh, he went there. And you're just like, oh, okay, this is giving you the catalyst for all of these things that happened after this one horrific event. And it takes until the end of the book for everything to come together and wrap up as nicely as he's going to let it.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be within the last 100 pages, if that, that you find out and you have that scene, which, you know, trigger warning, is a graphic rape scene, graphic gang rape scene, no less, racially motivated, that is... It's hard to read. And for me, it was hard to listen to, just like, oh, God. And how it's described feels all too real and all too upsetting. But the reaction to it then feels justified. You know, it's like, I kind of liken it to when I watched Midsommar and, you know, people ask, did the boyfriend deserve it? I'm like, well, of course he deserved it. Did you watch the movie? It feels like that's like, well, these old men kind of got what was coming to them. Those poor little children didn't deserve any of that. But these old men, like, this is the curse that's visited upon you for your monstrous behavior and the monsters that you spawned. Because as it's told from even the guy who's the caretaker and friend of Mike, who when he almost drops the N-word, and you realize that, like, oh, the apple hasn't fallen very far from the tree with this group of people. Like, they're not that much changed. It's not a situation where, like, their descendants have grown and become better. This is a situation where things have pretty much stayed the status quo that they were all those years ago.
And you can see that as everyone turns on Mike. You know, his housekeeper just up and quits and doesn't really give him any notice. She's just like, I'm sorry, I can't. And you do get a sense that she's doing so reluctantly because she knows that Mike and Joe had been so good to her over the years. But you can definitely tell the husband is behind it. And there's just this pressure, especially when Maddie loses her job at the library too. It's like, clearly those people liked her because she was in the book club with them. And yes, she was much younger than a lot of them seem to be. But there's just, like you said, this status quo that they don't want anyone getting in the way of, no matter who they are, where they live, or, you know, what they've contributed to this town. You know, Mike has probably spent a good deal of money there over the years, with it being his summer town and everything. So
he talks about Joe's contributions to the town, too.
Because of this impact that Mike and Joe have clearly had on this town, to see them turn on him the way they do, it's surprising, but not terribly unexpected, if that makes sense. You're kind of like, oh, he can't even get like two or three people on his side. It's really the whole town. And you're just like, okay, I understand how this town works at its core now.
Right. Like in Needful Things, when everyone succumbs to the influence, it feels like they are almost part of like a family, and everyone, you have to obey the family. You know, you have to do what the family says. And that's it. It's really only people who come from outside the town, like Romeo, who's from a totally different place, and George, who's also from somewhere else, and their lawyers from New York. And really the only person who's from the town is Maddie. And you feel like she's separated because it's her daughter that's under fire here. And she has such a strength of will that she is not going to let anything bad happen to her if she can prevent it.
Yeah, and you even have, you know, Mike's editor calling and checking in throughout the entire novel, too. And you get this sort of friendly banter between the two of them, but you can tell Mike is just so preoccupied with what's going on in the town. He doesn't really want to give anyone anything. And he'll give them just enough to keep them satisfied, so then we don't hear from them for a while. And it was just so clever the way this was done. But I think we can go ahead and dive into some ratings now. I gave this a 4 out of 5. I thought it was a really good King book, but I don't know if it would make, say, my top 5 list right now still.
Yep, that's right where I'm at. 4 out of 5. Like, I really liked reading it. I'll probably read it again in a few years. I was really entranced with how well he did the ghost story in this. Like, as we've talked about, there's so much positive to this and not a whole lot of negative. Like, in general, I was always willing to turn this one back on and read it, and excited to hear how it ended, and very satisfied with the ending. Like, I think this is a solid King book, and I think the only reason I wouldn't give it a full 5 out of 5 is because it's just not as affecting for me as, you know, something like The Stand or the First Dark Tower book or something. So it's I'm definitely rating it on like a scale of King rather than a scale of book quality, if you will.
Yeah. I totally get that. I'm still trying to figure out my King scale. I think by the time I get through all of these books, I might end up going back and making some adjustments. I'm probably going to try and challenge myself to stop using half stars and just, you know, do 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 out of 5. But it's one of those things where I'm just like, do I like this so much because it's a really good book in general, or is it a really good King book? And then, you know, maybe I'll do a bonus episode or something down the line on top 5 books, top 10 books, whatever. He'll have a bunch more out by the time I finish this, probably. Not a bunch, yeah. But, you know, there could be 1 or 2 in the works right now that come out before the end of the next year or two.
I mean, I think he's released 3 books since you started the podcast.
So. Yeah, I think so.
So I know there's been at least 2, because the one that just came out of like what, last week, and then
The Institute came out like September, I think.
Yep. And then before that was The Outsider. So there's been like probably more than 3 books he's released since you started this. So it'll go for a while.
Absolutely, because everyone keeps making adaptations too. But I think that wraps this up. Again, Katie, thank you so much for coming on to talk about Bag of Bones today.
Yes, thanks for having me, and I hope everybody enjoyed our discussion.
All right, that does it for this episode of Chat Cemetery. You can support the podcast on Patreon for $1 a month. You'll get a thank you on the show. For $2 a month, I will send you a Chat Cemetery sticker. And if you want to follow us on social media, you can do so at Chat Cemetery on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You could also rate and review the show. That's a huge help. And as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.